welcome to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. My name is Don Bishop, and I write as T.S. Pedramon. Here I am again with Noah Healy. He's been on before. I recommend you go and check out our conversation from several weeks ago. And today we're back at it. We're going to talk about our nominated topic is kind of building the future, where we're taking specific technologies that we see here today, or fields, I should say, and seeing where we see these going in the future, and how that kind of builds into the science fiction worlds that we might read about in books or see on movies. Now, for a reintroduction, Noah, you describe yourself as a recreational mathematician, and give us a quick little reintroduction for anybody who hasn't heard our previous episode.
Sure, yeah. So that's my name, Noah Healy. I have an interest in computational mathematics and the future, and I co-host a podcast with the former CTO of Reddit called The Fourth Age, where we talk about those topics. I work with computer systems and in designing algorithms. I've developed a marketplace that I'm fighting with the patent office about. And I'm pretty widely read in both science fiction and science fact.
Thank you. Before we hit record, we were talking about kind of what direction we're going to take with today's conversation. And we looked over what we discussed last time, which was heavy on cryptocurrency, and cryptography as well. Not just cryptocurrency, but other things that it does. I do see, and pardon the term, because I know some people dislike the term because there was too much hype a couple of years ago. NFTs, non-fungible tokens. It's basically digital certificates that are impossible or extremely difficult to fake. And I guess to open it up with cryptography, I see this as being ingrained in future technology at the, I hesitate to say at the lowest level, because, you know, what is the lowest level? Is it a single wire with bits being sent across it in different voltages? But that's not what I mean. I mean, where you might have small little devices that use cryptography of some sort, be it NFT on a blockchain somewhere or not, to identify themselves, to identify facts, like, yeah, I don't know. You go ahead.
Well, that's certainly a possibility, but we did have a guy on our podcast at one point who was he sort of ran the Air Force's version of Top Gun, if you will. Mm-hmm. And what their issue with cryptographic security was is that the battle surface is too large. And so the thing about what you said, like an NFT is something that's hard to reproduce, or expensive to reproduce. Well, we think it is. It is not publicly known that it is inexpensive to reproduce it. Hmm. It might be privately known to somebody that it is. And if the math problem that we associate with it is easy to solve, then it will be. And we don't know how to produce math problems that are hard to solve, or if indeed it is possible to produce math problems that are hard to solve. I always kind of go back to the past, but it puts me in mind of the story of Cardano. Back in the Renaissance time, the mathematical profession was somewhat more akin to court wizard than the way we think of it today. And mathematicians had sort of a reputation for this ability to solve problems, and they would issue open challenges to one another of like, you know, here's some problems, you know, you give me some problems and let's see how I do on your test and how you do on my test. Mm-hmm. So there was a mathematician whose name we don't really recall anymore, that solved the cubic. Most school children in this country are exposed to the quadratic formula. You know, if AX squared plus BX plus C equals zero, how do you put that together and get the roots? But there's a somewhat more complicated formula that will get you the roots of a cubic equation. And this guy had figured it out, and he took the secret, not quite to his grave. He passed it on to his apprentice, who wasn't as bright as he was. Mm-hmm. But the apprentice was a lot more ambitious than him. And he got himself cross-grained with this guy named, I believe, Cardano. And they had a competition. And the kid wasn't really, like, up to scratch. He wasn't a top-flight mathematician. He just had this trick. And so he filled up his entire problem set with cubics. He was like, well, you know, I can solve these, nobody else can. Uh-huh. So even if I can only get one of his, I'll still beat him on this. And so Cardano figured out the general solution to cubic equations and, you know, blew away the whole thing and published the results and, you know, showed off his work and stuff. And this kid was destroyed forever. And I can't remember the guy that actually came up with it or the kid's name anymore. But we've got the cubic formula now. And that, to some extent, is how we do cryptography. Government institutions mm-hmm. like the NSA or similar institutions in other countries quite intentionally find and vacuum up very high potential pure math graduate students and basically put them in a hole in the ground and shovel a lot of money down that hole. And that's it. They try to come up with math problems that nobody else can solve, and they try not to show their work to anybody else. There's been a little bit of movement back in the 70s. There were like export controls, and people got thrown into jail for talking about them. It's mm-hmm. opened up somewhat because it's become recognized that security is essentially impossible unless it's being done publicly. But because we know that security is basically impossible unless it's being done publicly, and governments are categorically unwilling to secure the entire space because they want to be able to snoop on your cell phone and your emails and anything else they can get their hands on. They have to accept the fact that their systems are almost certainly always compromised or could always be compromised. And so the focus is on making things that work even when they're compromised. So it's sort of a fail-safe type of a scenario.
Or on what to do once you are compromised. And I don't know if you remember this about me, but I worked in cyber defense, and it's not just the military. It's the whole cybersecurity industry. There are kind of some pillars to defense, and one is, yeah, you do everything you can to make sure your system is protected. You keep things up to date so that you're protected against known vulnerabilities. But there's a lot of activity focused on what to do when you are compromised. And there's a mindset of assume compromise, like assume that the enemy is in your system and you have to find them. And so then there's a lot of work to do with logging and analyzing to find what the enemy may have done. And then there's also, you said, like they vacuum up pure math graduates. And at the start of the book Countdown to Zero Day. Countdown to Zero Day, you might be familiar with, but most of my listeners probably aren't, is a book about the U.S. hacking Iran's nuclear refining process. And
right. This was the famous case where their computers basically crashed, and then we claimed credit for having infested them with viruses that would cause the project to fail.
Yeah, because it made the refinement cylinders spin out of control. But this book, at the beginning, it talks about how basically it's a known secret, or not really such a secret, but nations will buy vulnerabilities, or like if you find a vulnerability in a well-known, widely used software, the NSA will buy that information from you and pay you to not disclose it to anybody else, so that if they find the need to finagle with some other nation's systems, then they have the option, but they don't want the other nations to have that same option. And if you listen to the Darknet Diaries podcast, fascinating. And for my listeners, cause my podcast is clean. The Darknet Diaries has content that is not clean. I listen to it as education, because it talks about securing and how a lot of cybercrime has been committed. Like it goes into case studies of like this happened and this happened. It's really fascinating. Where was I going with that? Oh yeah. So like Israel has a unit. I don't remember the unit number. It's like 89 or something, but they have a unit dedicated to hacking other countries. And so there are nation states gathering up information about vulnerabilities. And this is definitely not where I imagined this conversation going, but hey, it's organic. It's interesting. I think what you were getting at is there's not public knowledge on how to easily break these systems,
yes. Because once that knowledge is public, then, you know, bored 12-year-olds are doing it.
Yeah.
And then it's over. That there's the bored 12-year-olds of the world have more resources than any nation state. So once they're on board, then chaos reigns.
Which is why if you want a good hard science fiction, you're not going to have somebody pulling out some old piece of computer gear, blowing the dust off, plugging it into something else, and then it working because of these vulnerabilities that exist, and just because systems advance and we find better ways to do things, the older ways to do things fall by the wayside, and new things after sometimes 5 years, sometimes 20 years, new things are not compatible anymore. Some things do hang on for a while, like VGA. The VGA video cable, you can still get like brand new monitors. I guess I'm assuming that. I tend to get used monitors because they're a lot cheaper. But VGA is a really old standard.
Yes. Yeah. So it's sort of an interesting thing that old technology actually having any life at all isn't something that used to be true either. So back in the like 50s and 60s, when the people that were developing computers built computers, they built the hardware and the software all in one go. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't the case when you bought the next generation of IBM hardware, that was a completely new machine and you would have to completely rewrite any software that you'd written. That's the sort of core reason for Unix as an operating system. The idea was to develop a piece of code written in a language that could be rewritten and recompiled for different sets of hardware and allow the existence of continuity between different generations, which then became basically the cornerstone of Microsoft's value proposition that they kept up backwards compatibility. And then finally in the 90s, their code base had become so complicated, they gave up on that. And so we've been becoming more complicated and more fractured, and to some extent, losing backwards compatibility, even on the internet, where websites are perfectly okay with, like, say, if somebody showed up with a Netscape 4.7 browser, not being able to use your website, because who could possibly stand to maintain backwards compatibility for that long?
So then, it can be utterly unpredictable to really try to project a multiplicity of technologies into the future, because disruptions happen. You know, disruptions happen where somebody invents something new and suddenly something that was used for years and years is obsolete. Probably 50 years ago, most people would think that today every house would have, maybe every bedroom would have, a landline telephone, and somebody just wouldn't expect that you have a cell phone and you can just go all over the place with it. Probably wouldn't have imagined satellite phones. So in some cases, you really can just go everywhere.
Well, and these changes can be quite dramatic. There's a pair of pictures that went viral a while back. It was like a New Year's Day parade or something in New York City. And it's in the early 1900s. So it's like 1904, 1914 or something like that. It's like a 10-year window. And in the first picture, there's one car and it has to be circled so you can see what it is. And in the second picture, there's one horse and it has to be circled so you can see where it is. So these sorts of usage transitions, if you're watching, you know, like 80s nostalgia, like Stranger Things or something, you know, nobody has a cell phone, or the Scream movies. It was a plot point that one of the characters having a cell phone meant that he might be a serial killer, because for what other reason would a teenager own a cell phone? Whereas, you know, current films, the writers have to, you know, take some trouble to either explain why the characters have no access to constant communication, or they just write it that way, that the characters, of course, they can talk to each other whenever they want to. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing, I think it was Kevin Smith, who was talking about how much one of the Spider-Man movies, that he's like live streaming, exploring the sewers of New York to his girlfriend. It's unrealistic because he has too much connectivity. Because
He's underground. I haven't seen the new Spider-Man movies.
This isn't the new Spider-Man. This is a while back.
Oh, with Andrew Garfield.
Andrew Garfield.
Yeah, I remember that.
Andrew like goes to the lair of the lizard. Yeah. That's what it is.
And there wouldn't be a signal down there.
And so, right, yeah. But nevertheless, they're teenagers. Of course, they have cell phones and they're like talking to each other constantly. So they just wrote it that way.
Yeah. So I what might be a fun question if you're trying to like build a sci-fi world is, what happens when what happens when we get really effective quantum computers and you throw an AI at some cryptographic problem and now it's solved. And now, like, I don't know, maybe Bitcoin is dead because it's too easy to hack.
Well, so yes, Bitcoin, the SHA-256 problem is what it's known as.
SHA is an encryption algorithm or standard.
Yes, and it's the SHA-256 is specifically a hashing algorithm that sits at the very core of the blockchain. Mm-hmm. And so far as anybody knows, it's a very, very hard problem to solve. Maybe impossible without the keys. On the other hand, maybe it is. And quantum computing has a window towards something that might speed it up considerably. If it turns out that you can rapidly solve that problem, then it becomes possible to forge blocks very cheaply. So right now, if I were to want to put a block on the blockchain that said, you know, whatever I wanted it to say versus whatever anybody else wanted to say, I would have to not just win the immediate competition, which thousands of computers around the world are beavering away at to try to solve the next block problem. I would have to, if I wanted to really say whatever I wanted to say, I'd have to create compatible solutions to all the historical solutions of the thousands of solutions that have already happened. And I'd have to do all of that faster than anybody else can solve the next problem. But if that problem became efficient to solve, I would be able to do that quite trivially, and almost anybody would. In which case, you could write a blockchain that just says that you're Satoshi, or that the blockchain protocol is invalid, or that, you know, unicorn aliens landed 40 years ago and they actually own 30% of all the Bitcoins.
Well,
because whatever you wanted to say, you could just write there.
But I imagine that with the difficulty, the level of challenging that it would be to solve that and to forge it on the blockchain, that perhaps as like when somebody is like, okay, now it's possible to solve this problem. Hypothetically, if somebody could do this and figure out all those faster than somebody could figure out the next one, then they could forge the blockchain. So since we can see this coming a little bit closer to potential realm of possibility, we're going to fork. Everybody's going to fork to a new blockchain using the next encryption standard.
Well, potentially, although if the solution space blows away encryption standards, which is out in the ether one of the ways that it could wind up going, then even that wouldn't work. And in fact, while blockchain likes to claim for itself that it has somehow solved this human trust problem, this scenario we're talking about isn't technically theoretical. Ethereum already did precisely this. So a society can simply decide for itself that it's going to decide things for itself. And Ethereum in 1.0, we could call it, had a bug that somebody exploited and basically gave themselves the Ethereum. And the very, very wealthy people who had, you know, founded Ethereum and owned most of it, forked it and said, we're gonna use this one. And anybody that wants to deal with us in the future is also going to use this one. And the Ethereum community decided that they were going to go with the people and not the chain.
Yeah.
And in general, societies, that's how they choose to do things.
Well, they were able to recover it, right? Because they forked it like a day or two in the past. So the thing hadn't happened yet. Didn't they?
Well, and so, right. Well, that's perfectly possible. You could fork blockchain from, you know, 10 years ago, if you wanted to. You could find each of the blocks is there. You could find a block from 10 years ago, and you could, Right. You could compute a next block after that one and say, the last 10 years has been bunk. We need to do this now. And if you were a global charismatic leader that billions of people were paying attention to, then you wouldn't need to solve SHA-256. You could just say it and people would believe you and go along with it and ignore those weirdo dweebs that still care about what this fictional blockchain thing says.
But if a dictator can just dictate a new whatever, then why does North Korea keep stealing cryptocurrency?
Because they
don't dictate over the entire world is why.
Well, it's not just that. It's that there's a disparity between human social decision-making and reality. Somebody like Napoleon had an enormous amount of faith placed in him by the people of France, but France still didn't have the technological power and manpower to conquer all of Western Europe and Russia, and that was demonstrated when Napoleon decided to put it to the test.
Yeah. Oh, I saw a meme. I don't remember though. I don't remember. Well, I don't want to spend all of our time on cryptography and cryptographic systems. I do see them still being hugely important in the near future. The deep future is impossible to really predict. But I think it's something that world builders like myself could definitely use. I wouldn't call it Bitcoin if I'm, say, 100 years in the future. 50 years in the future, I might call it Bitcoin. I don't know. But
you might. But yeah, one aspect of that might be useful for a world builder, it would be building up protocols more and more about security. So the aspect of Bitcoin and other sort of public protocols is getting lots of people to all claim they believe the same thing. And so there's other kinds of things like gossip protocols, which are a lot less expensive. Yeah. Where that kind of thing can happen. You could also have other kinds of like layers of fact checking and reputation space. There's some references to this in Neal Stephenson's book, Anathem, where their version of the internet, that it's a society that's thousands of years advanced beyond ours. Their version of the internet, in its low-level space, in addition to the kind of sort of TCP/IP errors where maybe a message didn't get transmitted because of garbled noise on the line or something else, they have multiple layers of AI-based systems that are evaluating how likely and how consistent data is before it goes out for general public consumption. And so like a random paparazzi picture won't really be able to be in the space because it would be too unconfirmed, but thousands of coordinated paparazzi pictures taken around the same time that all show that the new starlet appears to be pregnant, you know, would suddenly update her Wikipedia article or something.
Mm. Interesting. We could keep going on, but like I said, I don't want to spend all of our time on crypto. What about, 3D printing, and so material fabrication, maybe into nanites, or even...
Right. Well, in particular, if you're talking about building, that's a very fertile area. So 3D printing is already being used to make biological scaffolding and even... in some cases, biological materials, that there's been like transplanted material where like skin and so on is like 3D printed into new forms to self-graft and that kind of thing. It's also being used to construct civil projects. China currently has a project to build a dam, and the stated intention of the project is that there will be zero human labor on site. There's already been several different designs for automated printing on the scale of houses. And so just in terms of space, we currently believe that the future is going to have a lot more people in it. And so if we're going to have a lot more people and we want a lot more shelter, and in particular, if we sort of work out how to make all this work and we all get a lot richer at the same time, we're going to need a lot more shelter, because we don't just need sort of a hovel for an extra billion people. We need nice houses for an extra billion people. And perhaps even more than that. And so that space of roboticizing construction. But the really crazy thing, there's been a project going on for quite some time to design 3D printers that can print the components of themselves. And while that hasn't been solved yet, there's some multi-material 3D printers. I don't believe there's any 3D printers at this point that are capable of producing electronics at the scale that would allow for the construction of themselves. But again, that's a potentially game-changing.
Yeah, I just had to cut a little bit out, but you were saying that there aren't yet 3D printers that are at the level that they can print the electronic components themselves.
The electronic components of themselves, yes. But I've seen credible estimates that were like about $10 billion in investment away from that level. And if that were to be achieved, then at that point one of these things turns into two of these things, which turn into four of these things, which turn into, you know, that exponential growth curve would be faster than our exponential growth curve in all likelihood. Yeah. Combine that with the simplifications that exist around 3D printing technology right now, cleaning up that interface, which is another thing that potentially AI could help you out with. That's a computational problem. The combination of those two things would allow the construction of complex technologies, things like stoves, refrigerators, car parts, cars even, could be produced locally, at which point the majority of retail wouldn't really be a meaningful part of the economy anymore. A household could obtain bulk plastics and metals and other materials, which their 3D printer, which, you know.
I'd hope we can wean ourselves off of most of those plastics, but.
Well, I mean, to some potential, yes. But on the other hand, I'd also mentioned, if we want to get really crazy with it, Google's DeepFold team has now released a paper saying that they've actually built an enzyme that breaks plastics down into their constituent parts, potentially allowing for full recycling of plastic at the molecular level. So what if, instead of buying furniture, you had a device in your home that made furniture, and when you got sick of your couch, you could take it down to the device and it could be broken down potentially even to the base molecules.
When you say computer,
and as long as
recycle.
Yeah, right. And then instead of having a couch, instead of having that couch, you could have a couch with a new design, or perhaps a few chairs, or some other, you know, a table or whatever it is that you felt that your house would be work better with.
Uh-huh. Mm.
So, there's a number of challenges that are between here and there, but the potential that exists within this deep fold technology means that we ought to be able to start seeing designs for molecular scale machines allowing the construction and deconstruction of materials once again at the atomic level, with reasonably high degrees of design.
And you see,
we hook that up with,
sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, but yes, we hook that up with additive manufacture where we can make things happen by putting conglomerations of small amounts of stuff on something iteratively. And we start seeing a world in which you can have things built for you out of virtually anything at the price of having the raw materials, just sort of the elements on hand, plus a power source.
So like you, your brakes need to be changed, and your assistant robot says, okay, we need this part for some reason. I don't know why you're driving this old model. So we can't order the part. We have to make it, which we can do, but we need this much of this material, this much of this material. We found them at this store. Are we authorized to make this purchase? It'll cost this much. And all it takes from you is, yeah, go ahead and buy that. And then it gets delivered. Right. Your robot fabricates it and installs it. And
potentially it's not even that you have an old vehicle. Maybe it doesn't matter because it costs less to manufacture it in your garage out of bulk material than it does to buy one that gets shipped across, you know, a couple of continents. Because it's cheaper to ship just raw steel and other stuff than it is to do other things. So yeah, I mean that's something that we are cusping around that we could get to those. And of course, that has all sorts of implications. Right now, there's multiple ongoing legislative and legal efforts around what that does to the gun market. And so far, the manufacturers have been handily winning all of those cases, because in a world where you can make basically anything you want out of basically anything you have, you can't, if you want to define what a dangerous thing to have is, you'd have to define it as everything that's possible to be turned into that dangerous thing. Uh-huh. So if your gun manufacturing system can make a gun out of aluminum and an aluminum crutch is made out of aluminum, then you would be able to take an aluminum crutch, melt it down, and turn it into a gun. And so the legislature would have to declare that aluminum crutches were guns in order to stop you from being able to make a gun.
Well, I would see it.
That doesn't pass the laugh test, as you've just demonstrated.
Yeah. Well, I would see that's not a very practical solution to that problem. I would see it in software, where your the fabrication systems that are available on the market come from the corporations that don't want to get in trouble with the government. And I say the corporations. All of them, you know, they don't want to run afoul of the government because they don't want to get shut down. So the systems, the fabrication systems that they sell you, simply refuse to make guns.
That's certainly a possibility. But again, getting back to where I started, the real game breaker for literally everything would be if these multimodal systems could make themselves. And so once basically the first genius cranks one of these things off the shelf, then even if they decided that they had an ideological objection to the construction of, well, anything, they might decide that baby seats are a bad idea for all I care. But if iterative people using those systems to make new copies of themselves made tweaks to put in or remove restrictions. The potential becomes pretty wide pretty quickly. And so that's its own special fun world. I saw a YouTube video not too long ago where just as a hobby, it seems, a mechanical engineer decided to design a trebuchet that was supersonic.
Okay. Yeah, wow.
And it was an impressive thing. It's got a metal arm that's a little bit longer than a human arm. And he put like
what?
These incredibly big, thick, like... actually, he used these like 50-pound rubber bands, and he had like four of them. And it took him, it seemed, several minutes to, you know, crank it all the way. It was quite difficult. But when he you know, got behind the barrier and pulled on the little string, it sounded like the cracking of a whip. And it was just you know, a metal arm with a little sling on the end going.
Wow. I was going to say, so somebody's going to modify it. Somebody's going to do a modification of their fabrication system. I used to like to jailbreak my phone, not jailbreak, root my phone in my earlier Android phones. So I had a Motorola Atrix, and I had a custom ROM on that. I mean, I didn't customize it. I downloaded it. Somebody else customized it, and I could do things that Google hadn't provided for Android to be able to do. And I did that. I did a little bit of that with my LG Optimus G Pro. And then I stopped doing it when I got to Samsung phones, because I wanted to be able to use Samsung Pay. And anyway, so somebody's going to modify it. Somebody's going to modify these systems. Linux will still be around. There will be flavors of Linux, and somebody will, there'll be some software on the dark web.
That would be my guess, and that's pretty much how cyberpunk the genre works, is that you've got a world that's essentially technologically saturated, and there's sort of a large underclass of have-nots that have decided to begin carving out niches through modification of the saturation of the technosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But just at the base level, if multimodal manufacturing at parity or even lower cost is distributed across the full space, just as more television and movies are distributed digitally and then locally constituted rather than through actual film, from a central location, we could see the majority of the existing retail space of you know, all the little electronic gewgaws you've got, furniture, appliances, and so on, going similarly, where rather than having a plant to manufacture cars or washing machines or chairs, and then distributing those to potential customers, designers could operate online and sell design templates to people. Commodity product warehousers could, you know, ship pallets full of raw materials.
Yeah.
And then customers could basically throw these two things into the hopper and get products constituted in their own homes.
I was going to say, there's a little bit of a topic change, but I would see a wider democratization of the, to use a pun, of the retail space, not just the retail space, but the retail space. With AI going into video now. So I have my book. Let's go ahead and plug that. This podcast is brought to you by Nightshade Unicorn. So I have this, and I have some other stories that I've been working on for a long time. And so a couple of weeks ago, I was at an elementary school carnival for my younger daughter, and I was there as a vendor. I had my table, and I was selling my book. My older daughter cosplayed. Like, she dressed up as the main character of this book. It was her idea, and I thought that was awesome and fun. Anyway, so we have talked, you know, kind of joked around about movies, like doing movies. And with AI going into movies, it won't be too long before I'll be able to make a Nightshade Unicorn movie here on my computer. Now, will I do that? I don't know. Maybe I'm not at the point of considering that as an option at this time. But I think what's more likely, at least nearer to us, is to shoot and make a film with very low resources at hand because of AI availability. I have my phone, which has a pretty decent camera. I have my computer, which once I fix the ailment that it has been suffering from, is a pretty decent computer. It has, like, I did that as a point because I edit video for this podcast, and it's somewhat resource intensive. So I have a Ryzen 7, and I have a video card, an RTX 3070, so I can do some crunching. And I have this microphone that's out of frame, and I have another microphone that's right here. But with these materials, I could capture something halfway decent, run it through AI. If it's only halfway decent, I could clean it up with AI. I could use
I saw a project fairly recently, actually,
to the frame, add a unicorn.
Yes. Yeah, I saw a project fairly recently. So AI is being used to help out compositing, because the industry standard is the green screen or blue screen. And that has some, you know, color matching issues and some other compositing issues that AI, you can basically teach AI what's going on. And so modern digital, you know, Photoshop and things like that understand some of these artifacts and understand how to fix them. There's another process that's actually superior to them that Disney used on Mary Poppins. They used sodium lighting, And so they're using essentially only a single wavelength of yellow light is the only thing that they're taking out. And that's why Julie Andrews in the composites with the animated backgrounds when they're like having tea with the penguins and so on. She's got like a veil on. It's a very complex multicolor system against a very complex multicolor background. And the compositing is absolutely perfect because it's literally one wavelength of light is the only thing that's off. There's been a project recently.
I had no clue. I knew Mary Poppins had the first
one. Apparently the reason, apparently the reason they stopped using it is because the very special like lens that they had, they had this very complicated lens that allowed for this to occur. They lost it. Or it broke or something, and so they couldn't do it again. But some people recently have built a new setup that reconstructs the capacity and demonstrated this capacity. And so the key thing is that the reason they're doing it is to actually generate training data. So if you can show an AI a sort of a goal pair, a like, you know, this is a thing that I want to composite into this thing, and this is what it looks like when I composite two things together, and it learns like what that transformation looks like, then you can actually eventually get to the point where you could just shoot some stuff on your phone and generate some other stuff in a program and say, okay, composite those things into a frame together because it now understands what it means to do that.
And put them on this other background and adjust the lighting. So
right. Yes, exactly. It can start understanding what it means for things like that to exist if it can be given examples. And since this allows the production of effectively perfect examples, that could potentially create a setup where very disparate artists at very low costs could bring things together. At the same time, going back to our other example, it could be low cost to have studio lighting if you could have your 3D printer print you studio quality lights. That you could use while you were choosing to do some filming and then throw into the resource hopper again to be recycled back into your next hobby project.
Now for our listeners who may not be very cued into 3D printing capability, we're not near there yet.
We are not. 3D printing is largely confined to single materials per item. There are a wide variety of different single material items and a wide variety of different technologies within those that are all pretty effective at producing parts, but still require a pretty decent degree of mechanical understanding and generally. Yeah.
I have a 3D printer. It's broken at the moment. It's about 7 years old now, so it's getting on in years. But this is one of the finer things that I was able to print. So it's my printer and, you know, my finesse in using it and knowing what temperature is to set and how tall of a layer height to set, and all those things. I am no pro. I know other hobbyists. I know a personal acquaintance of mine who is also a hobbyist, and he's much better at it than I am. But, you know, this is the San Diego Temple of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. If you're driving down Interstate 5, you kind of come around a curve, and there it is. It's kind of imposing. In real life, the real building has, has windows here. You know, they're not totally gapped like that. But you were saying, Noah, it's confined to single material per print. You said largely because there are printers that can do multiple materials, multiple colors in a single go. But by and large, you have one material, one color per object that you print out. And this is, it's called composite manufacturing. If you look closely, you can see lines because it was built layer by layer. And where it's darker here, that's because the material was slightly burnt at those layers because of, I'm trying to figure it out here. I guess it's more empty inside right here. So you can see like at this level, there was a lot to be printed at that level. And then up here, there was not so much. So the material was sitting in the heated nozzle while the nozzle traveled from one point to the next and then to the next, and it got slightly burnt. By the way, this glows in the dark. It looks pretty nice. But
cool.
So it's, yeah, the plastic got slightly burnt there and there, and those are the primary levels. But it's somewhat limited. Pretty cool, but somewhat limited.
Yeah. Like I said, I've seen reasonably credible estimates that we're like $10 billion worth of R&D away from these, you know, the final switches uh-huh. getting switched.
Replicated.
But again, we'd be getting awfully close to replicator style technology with that. And if you're talking about building a science fiction world, having mass construction, so civil engineering projects or large buildings, having extensive 3D printing components to them would be potential game changers and alter the way things were going. And having household ones capable of multi-materials would completely alter the basis of your economics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's from a budget machine that I got. You know, I assembled it myself and it cost me less than $200 7 years ago. Now for $200, you can get something a lot nicer.
And even that for a hobbyist, if somebody's a war gamer, I'm not myself, but that can be an extraordinarily expensive hobby because of what miniatures companies charge for miniatures. And that problem solves itself if you have a device that can produce reasonably credible, miniature objects out of plastic for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even, yeah, I was going to say, or even like metal, because there are different 3D printers that can print sure. with different materials. Yeah.
There's metal. My favorite one that I've seen in the last couple of years, I think, people have developed a laser silicone technology that basically just has a gel, and they use some kind of sintering laser to coagulate the gel into silicone. And so they can create essentially in suspension. And it's the same kind of layer by layer kind of technology that you're talking about. But what comes out of it is it's silicone. It's, you know, floppy mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. And so gaskets and if you get thick enough, you could get implements and so on out of this basically chemically inert substance that is heat resistant up to hundreds of degrees. So that's something that has a lot of a lot of applications in, well, you know, the shop or the kitchen.
Yeah. Well, I think we've had a good conversation. And yeah, we'll cut it off there and let the listeners have a break until the next episode. But yeah, I'd like to get back together and I still want to probe kind of the biological side of things. Okay. We've got for another day. So, thank you for coming on. And for our listeners, you can check out his podcast, The Fourth Age, which is also on YouTube.
Excellent. Yes.
Thank you.